From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida. And it is a pleasure to welcome all of you to Tuesday Topics this evening. I'd like to thank our producer, Brian Charlson, and our editor, Steve Bauer, for the magnificent work they do turning these programs into effective radio broadcasts. And, of course, I'd like to express my appreciation to George Baez of Talking Communities, without whose generosity we would not be recording this program. Tonight, we are going to discuss an institution of ACB, but we're also kind of in passing, I think, going to end up discussing how people make decisions about the kinds of issues that we ought to get behind as blind people, what make for good advocacy issues and what make for bad ones, and perhaps we'll find out what some of the current issues that are being worked on by ACB through an institution called the Advocacy Services Committee. This committee is outlined in our Constitution and bylaws. And to tell us something about what it is and what it does, it gives me great pleasure to welcome a veteran of ACB conventions and someone I like to think of as a good friend, Miss Sue Amater. Welcome, Sue. And as chair of the Advocacy Services Committee, tell us a little about who you are and what you do.
Good evening, Paul and everyone. I'm pleased to be here tonight and to have a good discussion about advocacy. Topic I spend a lot of time on, it seems. Just to kind of give people a little bit of history about me, I've been a member of ACB, I guess, for about 18 years now. I've been involved in the organized blind movement for, oh goodness, over 35 years. I must have started when I was really young. And I was appointed chair of the Advocacy Services Committee by Mitch last July. I am retired now. I retired from King County. I live in the state of Washington in 2005, and we relocated actually out to a rural county and built our retirement home. But prior to that, my working life, I started out working for the Office of Women's Rights doing sex discrimination work. Then I went to the State Human Rights Commission, where I worked for over 16 years doing disability cases under the Washington state law against discrimination. We were actually one of the first states that had a state law, so we wrote the regulations implementing that and so forth. Then I began getting involved with the ADA when that was passed into law in 1990, and ultimately I went to work for our governor's office and then the Department of Personnel for 3 years, and we did ADA training for state employees. I think during the year time I did that, our project trained something like 8,000 employees, and we also did a lot of conferences and things to really get the word out about ADA and reasonable accommodation. And then I spent the last 8 years of my work life working for King County, which is in Seattle. I worked for Disability Services, and we provided accommodations for King County employees, and we also had a program if they could no longer do the job they were doing, then we would reassign them to another position they were qualified for so they could continue employment.
Gosh, that's excellent. So you bring a lot of experience and understanding of all of the laws that we operate with. Sue and I, by the way, are also serving together on a three-member group, which was appointed by Mitch this July, where we are going to be attempting to develop some model policies that will operate for baseball stadia and other kinds of stadia. So that's actually going to be fun. We work together to develop the NPR comments that ACB submitted, and there's probably more on Stadia than some of our members might have expected. So, you were appointed as chair last July of this thing called the Advocacy Services Committee. Tell us what that is.
To start with, and I think it was in, that year, we kind of changed the structure of the committee. Previously, the president had chaired the committee, and so I'm the first non-president, I think, to chair it, and then we have a variety of committee members. And we hear about issues from a variety of ways. People may contact one of the committee members. People might contact me. Sometimes they contact the president. Or, of course, they go to the ACB office and either contact Melanie Brunson or Eric Bridges, our advocacy and governmental affairs director, about issues. So it might be anything from, I'm working for a federal agency and they aren't accommodating me, to I got accused of shoplifting and I think it was because I was blind. And basically, then all of the issues come to our committee. And one of the things we've started doing this year is trying to meet on a more regularly scheduled basis. So usually about every 6 to 8 weeks we try to meet, which gives us a chance to hear, especially from Eric and Melanie, about the kinds of calls that the office gets. If we're going to be involved in any kind of litigation or filing an amicus brief, then we make a recommendation to the ACB Board of Directors what we think should be done, and it's up to them to determine if we should take that action. But we also just get a lot of calls where we can help individuals. Maybe somebody lives in a state and we can help refer them to the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the State Human Rights Commission, or Department of Justice. So frequently, especially since I am retired and have the experience and love to do this kind of thing, if a call comes to the ACB office from either a member or non-member alike from around the country, they're forwarded to me and I interview the person and then we decide what we're going to do from there.
So the committee is just a group of people who gets together, or do they have some specific powers that exist as part of the bylaws?
Now you're going to embarrass me because I don't remember exactly what the bylaws say, but we did a draft procedure some time back that, for example, if the committee gets together or we're contacted about an issue by Melanie or Mitch or Eric, then we might look at an issue, for example, and say, you know, I think we should file a friend of the court brief in this situation, so let's recommend from the advocacy committee to the board of directors that we do this, and then the board gives their approval for us to enter into, you know, those kinds of activities.
Yeah, and that's essentially what the bylaws say it's supposed to do as well. It basically is almost, I suppose, like a clearinghouse where advocacy issues are looked at, and if you have to, if there are more issues than ACB could handle, I guess you guys would be responsible for kind of prioritizing which ones you might have to let go if there were scarce resources, which there often have been.
Yes, I mean, if there were, let's say, we had two or three requests for an amicus brief and, you know, we had to spend some of our resources to do that. One of the things that's been great over the last year is, since we are meeting more frequently, a lot of the times we can handle a situation that comes from an individual kind of directly or indirectly by talking with them and then coming back to the committee and making recommendations. And of course, on the committee we have some folks that are attorneys who can help with the legal advice. Of course, Melanie's an attorney, Otis, Jeff Tom, Becky Floyd. I'm probably going to forget one of the attorneys. That'll be bad, won't it? I should go through Charlie Hodge. So I should go through the committee list a bit if we have time. But we've been able to pretty much delegate a lot of the work around, and since we know that our resources are pretty meager.
Excellent. So we come to it. What kinds of things have you guys been working on this year?
Well, probably the primary one that everybody is going to be familiar with, of course, was the currency case. that, as you know, we prevailed on, and an appeal hasn't been filed, so our attorney is looking at the next steps that we will be taking, and I have a feeling that we'll be sitting down at the table trying to start working on how can we make the currency accessible and move things along. So that's, of course, been, in my opinion, is for all of us, a significant victory for ACB. We are working with some employees in one federal agency where the feeling is that the 508 compliance is not up to what it should be, and so we are exploring with another attorney what steps we will take with those employees to provide them with assistance. Also, of course, we got a lot of inquiries from students about the LSAT and the graduate records exams and some of these tests that have not been very accessible, as we all know. And Eric is doing a lot of work in that area, and he's been appointed to a committee that's working on that very issue. And those of you who know Eric, he's very resourceful, very bright guy. We also had a situation in Texas where a person wanted to volunteer for the National Guard, and you do not have to go on military service to do that. There's other things that you can do, and he had been recommended, and when his name came to the general just said absolutely not, and the guy is very skilled in communications work. We had another case here in the state of Washington where a woman, because of an eye disorder that she had, she's very sensitive to light. She had to wear both dark glasses and a hat, or otherwise her eyes would just close on her and she couldn't function. Well, she tried to apply for her non-driver's ID, and they said, we have to take off the hat and glasses. Well, she couldn't, and so finally we worked with she and her doctor, and the doctor recommended that she had to wear the hat and glasses. First they said, well, she can leave the glasses on, but she has to take off the hat. Well, when she finally went to see them about the non-driver's ID, they just said, okay, we're going to take the picture as is, and they took the picture and issued her the ID. So it was interesting because I don't know that issue had ever come up in any other state as we discussed it on our committee.
Hasn't, as far as I knew, has there been any progress made or with regard to the Texas case? Are you guys planning to move forward with that?
Well, he actually just got tired of fighting with them. We were trying to help him make some contacts, and he went to Justice and EEOC, and they weren't as responsive as we would have hoped. But he actually now has signed up for what's called Coast Guard Auxiliary now, and he's been in training with them, and he's really happy. He's just kind of put the other behind him and moved on. We were kind of disappointed that we couldn't get more response from the Texas governor's office, but, you know, sometimes that's politics, I guess.
I wonder what we could do to actually hear more about some of these cases, because I suspect there are a lot of our members who might be interested in emulating this gentleman. I know there was certainly a time, not anymore. I think they'd quite rightly turn me down as kindling now, but there was certainly a time when I would have liked to have gotten involved in some sort of active service, and I never even considered trying the National Guard. So aside from the guy's cleverness in terms of doing it, I wonder, A, how it is that we haven't heard very much about the case, and B, whether you guys have given any consideration to publicizing the kinds of cases that you're working on so more of our members would know what you're doing.
We've talked about it. I have to confess that I'm not the best one to be writing articles, although I should be doing it more. But I think we might see if we can't get some volunteers from the advocacy committee to maybe, every other quarter or so, send something to the forum that kind of gives an update. Let's see, I'll find out who's not going to be at our next meeting and I'll put their name in. No, it's, you know, all of us should be better about writing these things up than we are, and we don't do it.
Have you guys discussed some of the kind of oh, the other ADA cases that are around the fast food case in New York, or the way that the guide dog case in Iowa has gone?
Actually, we haven't, because we met in May, and then we kind of took off for the summer, since especially Melanie and Eric were stoned under with the convention. So we haven't met for a couple, 3 months. We actually have our next meeting scheduled for next week, so we'll have a lot of catching up to do. I do want to mention another thing, Paul, that I forgot about, and it started kind of in the advocacy committee and then branched out, but as a lot of people may or may not know, there's not a lot of very good health care information out there for blind people. And last year, as maybe some of you know, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So I went to the American Cancer Society and said, do you have anything in Braille? No. You'd have to go up on our website. Well, everything was up on the website was in PDF files, most of them which I couldn't open very effectively. And, you know, as many folks know, not everybody on the planet has a computer. You know, about 75% or more of blind people don't. Well, to kind of make a long story short, I ended up going to the National Braille Press, who I think quite they're a terrific organization, and we are going to be having published two books on breast cancer and prostate cancer, probably in the month of September, and they will be disseminated for free. And of course, you can also download them as a porta book. And then we're going to be working on putting that same material onto cassette tape or CD so we can get it around to folks who aren't Braille readers. And then after these two books are done, then probably the National Braille Press will do some material on diabetes. So in the front cover of the book, they do recognize the work of ACB in making this material accessible. So I think we're, and then we need to start working with places like the National Cancer Institute, American Cancer Society, and the American Diabetes Association, I think of ADA. All of these entities have an obligation to make their material accessible to us. So we want to start cracking into the healthcare industry, and when people go for their checkups and so on, that you do have a right of confidentiality, and you shouldn't have to fill out your forms in the waiting room in front of everyone. So that's an issue that we're starting to scratch the surface of.
I think it's a very worthwhile issue. When I went through a somewhat lengthy period of hospitals and so on 3 or 4 years ago, I got all fired up and actually wrote a resolution the following year, hoping that we could work cooperatively with some other organizations on starting to get some of this stuff done. I'm also really concerned that hospitals have no idea how to treat blind patients, but also that none of their consent materials are available in Braille so that somebody can read them. They've all got to be read by somebody else, and those people often don't do a good job of reading them because they're more concerned with the patient, quite rightly, and trying to figure out a way to move forward with getting things done. So, gosh, I certainly support any work that can be done there. And if there's some assistance that I can be, by all means, let me know. That's kind of exciting. Before I open it up, are there some other issues that you'd like to put on the table?
Well, let me just add in the healthcare arena that we have been having some discussions with Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian about maybe doing something in the area of structured negotiations, and we're not sure where we're going to start. Maybe it would be one big healthcare system like, what's the one in California, Kaiser, or Group Health, which is a big one here in Washington. So we might want to take on some of this, because you're right. When you go into the hospital, they throw so much paperwork at you, and not everybody has somebody that can read it to them. Or maybe you don't want people to read your personal health care stuff.
I think that's very well worthwhile. One of the things that my resolution contemplated was working through accrediting organizations who accredit hospitals and asking them to make disability stuff in general a part of their accreditation process or a more serious part, and perhaps helping them design some standards that hospitals would then have to comply with and in order to remain accredited.
What year was that resolution? Obviously, you can see how well I remember years.
I think it was either 2005 or 2006. I'm thinking it might have been 2006.
Okay, and I wasn't at convention that year, but you know, if you still have that resolution in your computer, or I could get it from ACB too, it'd be interesting to take a look at and just decide what we want to do and share it with Linda and Lainey and kind of put together a game plan. But as you know, when you start tackling any of these issues, I know last year when I couldn't get any Braille, I was really mad. Well, then I started being involved in all my own healthcare stuff, and that takes so much time that pretty soon it always takes a lot more time than you think it's going to.
It does. I was in the hospital with a heart attack about 2 years ago, so got to play some of the same games as you and Gail and others in our organization have, too.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Okay, let's open it up and see if folks have some questions for Sue about either the Advocacy Services Committee or more generally, if you like, about some advocacy issues, because Sue is a very wise and canny person.
I have to state here before, and this has absolutely nothing to do with you, Sue, or the committee as it presently stands, but I have to say that back in 2002, I had my own fight with accommodation, reasonable accommodation, and lack thereof. And actually, the result of that fight is that I'm not working today. I have to say, I hope things have improved drastically, not only with ACB, but also in that arena in general. I found that even I went through the Department of Fair Employment and Housing here in California. The counselor there, the initial investigator, said yes, he was being discriminated against, and he was trying to resolve the issue. His superiors didn't want to hear about it. They did not want to hear about a blind person being discriminated against on the basis of in employment. So I ended up having to pull the case. It was a decision I made, and went through it privately. And you know, when you talk about this gentleman who was trying to go to the National Guard, by the way, he is actively on, or has been on the trekker list, so I know he's out there. Can't remember his name, but now I know who you're talking about. He's there. It just seems to me that maybe it's because blindness is, I want to use the word sexy here, but it seems like it's not not a very successful line of endeavor to try to even when you are being discriminated against. Do you have any comments on that, Sue?
Well, I'm not going to say that most of the fair employment agencies that understand disability, because they don't, either because they don't have anybody with a disability on their staff, or they just haven't had the kind of training and experience that they need. And I saw this a lot at the Human Rights Commission, not only for blind folks, but other disabilities, where the staff didn't understand what reasonable accommodation was or how someone could be accommodated. One of the things we've been lucky to do here in the state of Washington is to find an attorney who understands disability, who we can go and do a case consult with, and sometimes he will take a case on contingency, but it's an uphill battle. I spent a long time trying to help someone else here in the state of Washington, and the agency found in her favor, and the employer said, we're not going to comply with the agreement, we don't care, see what you're going to do about it. So it is an uphill battle, and sometimes I wish I could say we'd move farther ahead since the passage of the ADA or are there state laws? And sometimes I feel like we move ahead a little and then we drop behind. But it is frustrating.
Another question for Sue, or perhaps another comment? And by the way, that mystery voice that you heard a little while ago is Dave McElroy from Visalia, California.
This is Brian Charlson from Watertown, Massachusetts. So when the committee decides to take on something, does the number of individuals that particular issue is going to affect play any part in your decision-making process, or do you really take them one-on-one?
Well, so far, since I've been chairing the committee, we haven't had to do that. We've been able to pretty much respond to everybody who's come to us in one way or the other. Of course, we don't provide legal assistance to everybody, but I would say if something were to come to us, like the situation I mentioned earlier that is impacting a number of people employed in a federal department, and we know there's a lot of people employed who are blind, that's going to get higher priority, or the currency case, that kind of thing. We might take on an individual piece of litigation. We've always been able to come up with another way for the person to pursue that. So, you know, luckily we've been able to spread our resources, both financial and people, around pretty well. And of course, we have some good advisors on our committee, like Melanie and Oda Stevens, who are pretty cognizant of what's out there for resources.
Let's talk just for a minute about that case, because it's sort of surprising. At the federal government level, there are some agencies that appear to actually do a pretty good job. They've set up infrastructure to deal with Section 508, and they actually have employees who work on 508 compliance and do training within their agency on what 508 compliance means and so on. And there appear to be other agencies of the federal government who essentially have done absolutely nothing, who haven't publicized the fact that 508's out there, who haven't done any training, who don't appear to be accommodating employees when they come along. So clearly this would be a really important case. Are you dealing with an agency that has a pretty poor track record?
Unfortunately, that's how it appears. The number of people who've come to us have all filed complaints, and basically they've never received responses. So we're looking at how we're going to take this on. And of course, as you know, when you go against a federal agency, their amount of resources is a lot more unlimited than ours, because they just spend our tax money. So we're really working very hard on a strategy right now to, you know, maximize what we can do with the resources we have available.
Once the currency case was settled, did that in effect stop being a purview of your committee, since it's really no longer a legal issue? Or are you guys going to retain jurisdiction? And if so, kind of what's the basis for doing that?
That's a good question. I would kind of think that what we've done thus far is always had updates from Melanie, who is primarily working with Jeff Levitke on this. So I would think we would get updates from her as they were relevant. But in terms of actually probably doing much, our committee won't, other than to kind of just be a watchdog. And the other thing that we've started doing is making sure that we have minutes from each meeting, which kind of lets us go back and have a track record of what happened when and how. And so I guess if Mitch were determined that we no longer should be involved with this, he'd probably let me know, but I kind of have a feeling that we'll just get updates from Melanie.
So when an individual brings an issue to ACB in whatever means, is there any kind of means test involved before ACB invests its money in lawyer fees?
No, there is not. We just go ahead and take a look. Most of the time that we've spent money on lawyers' fees, however, at least since I've been involved, it's been an amicus brief or a larger situation. I'm not saying we've never hired an attorney for an individual, but right now it's not coming to my mind that we've done that. Usually we'll have them go through the an agency first, or, for example, Justice or EEOC, or because they're going to have to get a right to sue letter anyway.
Well, I'm going to be more direct than Brian was. Do you think that it's appropriate for us to apply a means test?
For me, no. Mostly because I probably wouldn't want to have to do it. But most people wouldn't have the resources. I mean, even if you have a pretty good job, to hire an attorney unless they were to get the case on contingency. I've never discussed it with the committee to get other people's feelings. I'd be curious what others on this program think. But I guess to me, if someone suffered from discrimination and we can't get it resolved in any other way, I'd try to figure out a way of representing them. Obviously, it'd be nice if we could get a lawyer who would do it on contingency. But even when that happens, by the time you pay the filing fees and everything else involved, the individual is probably going to have to put out of pocket, even if we did help them.
In a valiant effort to tie up loose ends, in one of your examples early in the program, you mentioned as an example, someone who was caught shoplifting and who decided that he was only being prosecuted because he was blind. Was that just a case that came out of whole cloth, or did a case such as that actually exist?
There was a case like that. It was in Michigan, and what we asked is if the Michigan affiliate could provide some assistance to this individual, because he was being harassed by the prosecutor and the police, and the Michigan folks were able to help him, so we referred the case back down. That's probably another thing I should have mentioned, Paul. If it looks like there's people in the affiliate that can help, we might refer a case back down to the affiliate. Like, for example, the case here in Washington I mentioned with the non-driver's identification, I pretty much handled that with the lady. So if we have somebody in a state, or we know of an attorney in a state, or somebody in our attorney's affiliate, we might refer the situation.
Finishing up the questions associated with funding of things. So, when does NELS come into play when it comes to funding advocacy activities?
Well, I actually have gone to NELS to ask for assistance with the work we're doing with the 508 situation. And we also may go to government employees and other places, because the amount of resources ACB could commit won't be enough. Thus far, NELS has not responded to me, so I guess to answer your question, I'm not totally sure. I know that they have been involved in some wine vendor issues in the past, but since I've chaired the committee, NELS has not given us any support.
Just as a footnote, NELD stands for the National Education Legal Defense Fund, I think, or Legal Defense Services, I'm sorry. And it's an organization that is indirectly affiliated with ACB and has certainly worked with ACB on a number of issues and done some program components on the ACB program. The president is an ex officio member of the NELDS board. Other questions for Sue?
Actually, yes, Sue, and I hope I can tie this into an acceptable form. We have an first of all, I had a comment. As some of you know, I've just had some very minor knee surgery, and I'm in a position now where I'm going to have to have assistance with getting the questionnaire that the hospital sent me, the kind of evaluator gave me when I left, the evaluation survey done. I'm going to take it to my therapy location, well, the center where I have had my therapy performed, and they will do it, but I'm sure. But in this case, I really want to acknowledge the hospital because they were good. As far as my question goes, we're in an interesting situation whereby several years ago, and we do not have an active chapter locally, there just wasn't enough interest, unfortunately. Dave and I went out, and between the two of us and some press coverage, we got a detectable, or rather audible traffic signals. Yeah, we'd like the warnings, too. Audible traffic signals on some of the very busy highways, well, busy thoroughfares, which happen to belong to the state. They're part of the state highway system. The city's approach is, it's not our, you know, why should we spend our money, and it'd be a great idea if somebody else will fund it. The state chose the Chirp Chirp Cuckoos because they were doing, they felt absolutely justified digging up the highway to put in others. Well, they are now in the process, and they said, when we finish this, when we widen the road in 2 or 3 years, we'll put in the more detailed signals. Well, they are now in the process of tearing up the road, and we are so concerned that they're going to either A, forget all about us, or B, put back the old signals on the corners where they were, but we're concerned. Now, we have emails going back. Should our advocacy approach be to just say, we're back, and remind them and ask them and tell them that we do need this access, and what in the world can we do to the city? It's a pretty poor area, and even some of the comments in the online newspaper responses that Dave posts, the answers are, it's not our problem. And any ideas what we can do to make sure that we at least don't lose what we have and maybe gain more?
Well, I think a letter, even from the state organization, you know, Jeff Tom or Gene Lozano, I think, I don't know if in California you have an environmental access committee, I can't remember, but I know you have an advocacy committee, and I would think a letter to the state certainly would be appropriate. I'm not as well versed in all the laws that impact environment as I am employment, but I would also think that you could contact our environmental access committee, and I think Pat Beattie still chairs that, but I'm not sure. Paul, do you remember?
Yeah, Pat Beattie is still the chair. I'm happy to say she worked with us on our NPRM comments, and also, of course, shares with you, Sue, being a fellow breast cancer person. She's going through what I guess you're pretty much finished with now.
Yeah, Pat is just finishing up this week her radiation, so she might not be as available. I mean, she's been terrific. I can't believe all she's done during the time that she's had this. But I would think if you contacted Jeff or Gene Lozano out in California and got some letters going, that would be where I think I would start.
Other questions for Sue or other issues that people might like to raise?
I would be curious if anybody has any thoughts about whether we should employ a means test. I actually never thought about it, so I'd be curious what people think.
The floor is open, folks. I will stick in my 2 cents at the end, but the floor is open for anyone who would like to comment on whether in a case of discrimination, the ACB, in terms of using its scarce resources, ought to apply a means test.
Yes, and this is Pam Drake in Visalia, California. I think I may have forgotten that as well. I think it would be, I hate to say whether we should or shouldn't, but I do think that what Sue said in terms of having to expend much money in filing the documentation and preparing for the case, the person is more than likely going to have out-of-pocket expenses. Perhaps as I say this, thinking a stream of consciousness thought, I'm thinking perhaps maybe if we had to employ a means test, rather than a means test, we might say after the person has expended such and such an amount or has received help from other sources, if they still cannot continue to fund themselves, then maybe we would be able to go through this and not have to employ a means test. I mean, if that were the last resort, that would be the last resort, but it would be nice to be able to spend our resources and husband them wisely, but not leave anyone out. I guess that would be my thought.
Brian, it was your question originally. Would you like to come in with an opinion?
Yeah, that's probably going to be very politically incorrect, and as usual. My thoughts would be that means tests are appropriate in virtually all aspects of our lives, I think. If an individual is a very well-off as a result of, you know, whatever career they're in or whatever they've inherited from previous generations or whatever, I'd hate to think that we're not doing something for someone because of a limited amount of means while we are funding things for an individual who actually can. It's been frustrating to me over the years to know people of affluence who choose not to pursue services of one kind or another because the state won't pay for them rather than for them to pay for it themselves. And this has that same kind of feeling to it to me. So I think a means test is appropriate as long as the cost of administering the means test doesn't offset any financial advantage to ACB of that means test. So if it costs more to do it than we actually gain, then I don't think that we ought to do it. But if it actually saves a bit of money so that we can do a better job of advocacy, then I think that we really ought to take the time and effort to apply it.
Anyone else want to jump in with an opinion before I give Sue the benefit or lack thereof of mine?
I'm not sure. I'm actually trying to settle my Quicken accounts here while I'm doing this, and I'm listening to this. You know, I think a certain amount of means testing, yes, but I know for me, were I a contributor, I would have a problem contributing to an organization if I felt that, you know, people with in other words, somebody's going to have to define what's reasonable means. And I think that Brian could be opening quite a Pandora's box there. I would not want to contribute to an organization that said, well, person X does, you know, deserves our help and person Y does not. I will tell you that right now. If I were a supporter, I would withdraw support from that kind of thing.
Well, I take kind of a different view. I think that discrimination is discrimination. And what ACB needs to look at, and what I think we always have looked at, both when these matters got discussed by the board, but also when the Advocacy Services Committee came into existence, I think what we do look at, Brian, is what you talked about, which is the greatest good of the greatest number, is one of the issues that at least to some degree determines what we're going to do. But I think the other factor that I would put on the table is ultimately, whether we like it or not, at least in the foreseeable future, we're going to be playing Russian roulette, if you like, with advocacy issues, where a number of the bullets will end up being ejected from the gun. Because we simply don't choose to fire them. And I think whether we're honest or not, consciously or unconsciously, one of the factors that helps us to make that determination is whether we feel that the individual who is involved in the case has some other options that they can go to. So if an individual was pretty wealthy, that individual would actually have some other options that wouldn't be available to somebody who was on SSI. And I think that whether we do it consciously or unconsciously, I think that all of us in decision-taking positions in ACB tend to favor those individuals with the least resources when we're making decisions about how we're going to proceed, even though I don't think we ever have, nor do I think we ever should, apply a means test.
Well, let's hope we don't have to. Well, I'm chair, okay? But, you know, you never know. I can't think of a situation really where we've faced that. Just because, as everybody on knows, when you get into hiring any kind of legal help, you can run up a bill so fast that by the time you get out of the office, you can run up a $1,000 bill by a 2 or 3 hour consultation without any difficulty. So I guess we've never really faced a dilemma at this point.
One other issue or question for Ms. Sue Amater, who is our guest, who is chair of the Advocacy Services Committee for the American Council of the Blind.
Brian here again, another question. And I can ask all these questions because I wonder, you know, if I were ever appointed to this committee or that committee, how would I deal with things that I see them dealing with? And they're not easy things to deal with by any means. Have you ever been put into a situation where you had to decide to put emphasis on one thing versus another? For example, if the person is being discriminated against in terms of access to recreation as opposed to access to employment, as opposed to access to the health care system, have you ever had to prioritize as a committee those kinds of things, which would be considered more essential than others?
You know, we, at least since I've been involved, we haven't had to do that. Maybe one of the reasons we haven't publicized our committee a lot is because, you know, when you open the door, you know, the floodwaters come raging in. But I think we're getting more calls than we used to get. But I'll draw a little parallel. Here in the state of Washington, we have an advocacy committee in WCB. I don't know how the word got out, but anyway, I'm amazed at the number of calls that we get. And one of the areas where we've gotten calls have been blind people who have been discriminated against, who are a client, a participant, I guess you're supposed to call them now, in rehab, and they've been referred to us for at least consultation. And we had a really interesting case here that, if we have time, I'll go into, that involved a fellow who went to work, and as soon as the president of the company realized he was blind, he was summarily sent home, never to return again. And that's actually where we found our attorney. And even though we gave him some help in terms of, you know, paying for the consulting time with the attorney and so on, when it came time to filing the case and paying all of the discovery fees and so forth, it ended up costing him nearly $40,000. Thank goodness he prevailed and was awarded that money as part of his settlement, but they had to take a second mortgage out on their home. So it gives you a perspective of what things could cost.
And I think it also indicates why there aren't more cases filed under the ADA and Section 504 or 508. And I guess we might add to that, whereas with other laws, if you do prove discrimination, you can file for punitive damages. There is no such thing in either the ADA or the Rehab Act. Is that not correct, Ms. Sue?
I think you're right, and so that makes it really difficult for the person if they're, I mean, let's say you only lost a little bit of pay, you may not get much back, and it's even hard to prove, like, emotional distress or any of that. And the other component to discrimination cases is when you decide to take on, let's just say your employer or former employer, it's a real emotional roller coaster, and it's a long ride. So I can sympathize when somebody says, I don't want to go through the process, because it's very long, it's very involved, and it's frustrating. And you really have to be in it for the long haul, and if you're married, so does your spouse. That's why I really respected this fellow in Washington, that he and his wife were in it for the long haul. He did prevail. And what was really neat is then they came to our WCB board meeting and gave us a donation to bring some people to conventions for part of our convention. So it's a tough thing, whether you file an administrative case or you file in the courts. It's a real emotional roller coaster.
This is Pam Drake again. Yes, I can empathize with that, because when Dave went through his case, and he did prevail, but I was making phone calls during the time that he was at work, and it is a hard, and I was in the courtroom, and there were times when I just wanted to scream. It is an emotional roller coaster, and I know that it took Dave a lot of, well, my New York recent legacy of living there, chutzpah. It took a lot of guts to do something if you're not the kind of person who does such. But yes, I agree with you, Sue. It does take a lot out of you emotionally, and all you can do is hope that you will prefer not to have had to do it. Yes, prevail and be when you go into it, you don't go into it lightly.
No, absolutely, absolutely you don't. And that's one of the things when I talk to people about pursuing litigation, I tell them it's going to be tough. Don't think it's going to be easy and that you're not going to get frustrated, because I think people need to know. That doesn't mean I'm trying to talk them out of it, but in this particular situation, I talked a lot to both the husband and the wife, and she would call me in tears and say, we were in court today, and they said these terrible things about my husband, and I said, you just have to not listen, because that's what they try to do. They want to discredit the plaintiff.
We're actually approaching the end of our program, and I guess I'm going to take the liberty of asking the final question. And that is, you've served on advocacy services for longer than you've chaired it. And with your experiences, first, what kind of marks would you give it as a committee? Is it useful to ACB? And second, I guess that's probably a sort of a loaded question, but it isn't intended to be. But second, what would you like to see changed in terms of the advocacy services committee to perhaps make it function better?
Well, I do think it's an important committee, because we know there's a lot of discrimination out there and a lot of things that happen that shouldn't. I guess another case I forgot about was the one involving the parents, you know, where they try to take custody of their child. And, you know, we've had other situations. What I'd like to see, and we're going to try to do this hopefully more in the upcoming year, is to identify more attorneys around the country that could help us. So if I had a call from somebody in Oregon, do I know of an attorney in Oregon that I could refer them to for a consult if I couldn't help them? So we're going to try to identify more people in that direction. We probably need to do more, a better job of publicizing the kind of cases that we take on. So I may try to identify some people on my committee. But I think we're also going through some growing and changing pains, you know, of how often we meet and the kind of records that we keep and so forth. So I feel like this year we're going to be growing. And I did have some time last year for 4 or 5 months that I wasn't able to do very much, so the committee got kind of put on hold. So I want to get us up and running in September and try to do a lot more this year.
This is Dave McElroy, and I would like to add one more thought before we close in terms of, and that is that, one of the things that I would have to say is, aside from this committee, when you fight a discrimination case on the basis of disability, and especially on the basis of blindness, and I can say this from experience, you walk alone. You walk alone. I cannot emphasize that enough. And, certainly Sue and her committee can be of help, but the bottom line is you, and you walk alone. And Paul, I think that is probably the main reason why people don't just do it. They're afraid of that aloneness, and you are a part. Believe me, as I said, I have the personal experience to prove it.
Just to be sure that I understand what you're talking about, Dave, essentially, when you say you walk alone, do you mean that none of the people you thought you were your friends will support you? Do you mean that other blind people won't support you? Is that kind of what you're looking at, or is it something different?
Yes and yes. I would say to the affirmative to both of those that you've stated.
Yeah. And I think actually just having a committee that's behind you and that says that you're doing some good things and that your case is worth considering and that you're not the dumbass that everyone is making you out to be are actually pretty invaluable in themselves. Sue, final thoughts?
Well, let me just say again that if people... You can certainly contact the ACB office and talk to Melanie or preferably Eric, but people are certainly welcome to contact me or any member of my committee. And let me just go through the committee again. I've mentioned Melanie is on the committee, Becky Floyd from Mississippi, Charlie Hodge from Virginia, Pratik Patel from New York, Mitch Pomerantz from California, Dr. Otis Stevens from Tennessee, and Jeff Tom from California, and Eric Bridges. But people can feel free to email me or contact me.
Do you want to give folks your email address so that they will have it?
Yeah, my email is sue.amateur, A-M-M-E-T-E-R, at cablespeed.com. And my phone number is 360-437-7916. And again, I live in Washington, so we're on the West Coast time zone.
Sue Amateur, I'd like to express my appreciation, the appreciation of ACB Radio, and the appreciation of all of the folks who hung out tonight for your being our guest this evening on Tuesday Topics. It's really been enjoyable talking about some of the issues that come up from this. If anyone out there in our audience would like to send a message to Tuesday Topics, you can do so by sending an email to tuesdaytopics@acbradio.org, tuesdaytopics@acbradio.org. We do welcome your suggestions. I try to respond to everyone who does send me emails, so you can at least expect to hear from your erstwhile host if you do send us a message. But we do look forward to hearing from you. I think the other thing this program has done is to indicate how important advocacy as an idea is and how important it is that ACB have a structure that can help us to make good decisions concerning the kind of advocacy that we put ACB as an organization behind. Again, Sue, thank you very much for being here. Everyone else, good night. And remember, if you don't stand up for yourself, people will tell you to sit down.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.